U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrives in Israel.
It's clearly not in the interest of anyone, Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah for that matter, to see this escalate.
Taiwan prepares for presidential elections this week.
Small country like Taiwan, we have to play smart. We cannot afford to went into war with China.
And using robots and artificial intelligence to fight mosquitoes carrying dengue fever.
Mosquitoes are like human mothers. They want their children to grow up in their ideal environment.
Today is Tuesday, January 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is scheduled to meet with Israeli leaders on Tuesday in his quest to keep the Gaza conflict from growing into a regional conflict. Earlier on Monday, a senior commander of the militant group Hezbollah was killed in an Israeli airstrike in southern Lebanon, raising concerns of a wider war.
Well, first, Ian, with regard to Lebanon, it's clearly not in the interest of anyone, Israel, Lebanon, Hezbollah for that matter, to see this escalate and to see an actual conflict. And the Israelis have been very clear with us that they want to find a diplomatic way forward that creates the kind of security that allows Israelis to return home. Nearly 100,000 Israelis have been forced to leave their homes in northern Israel because of the threat coming from Hezbollah in Lebanon, but also allows Lebanese to return to their homes in southern Lebanon. And we're working intensely on that effort and doing so diplomatically. Second, with regard to the Red Sea, the international community as a whole faces a challenge. These attacks, consistent attacks by the Houthis on international shipping, are a threat to everyone. We talked about this yesterday. You've got about 15% of the world's commerce every day going through that strait, going through the Red Sea. And these attacks are having a real effect on the prices that people have to pay for food, for medicine, for energy. Ships have to get diverted to other places. Insurance rates go up. And the basic principle of freedom of navigation is what's at stake. So the international community has a real stake in upholding that principle. As I said, we've had 40 countries come together to make clear that what the Houthis are doing has to stop. And we have other countries that have made clear that if it continues, there have to be consequences. So our strong view, our strong preference is that the Houthis get the message that they're receiving from countries around the world that this needs to stop. And that's what we're focused on.
Blinken met Monday with the leader of the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi before traveling to Saudi Arabia for talks with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. From Israel, Blinken will travel to the West Bank in Egypt on Tuesday and Wednesday before returning to Washington. Now, here's an interesting development in the Middle East conflict. Until recently, observers say Washington had largely sidelined Turkey in diplomatic efforts to resolve the Israel-Hamas war. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the visit by Blinken to Turkey in the last few days signals that has changed.
Observers see the decision by Secretary of State Antony Blinken to start his latest regional Middle East tour with visits to Turkey's foreign minister and with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan as symbolically meaningful. Analysts say Erdogan's backing of Hamas initially had Washington largely sidelining Ankara in efforts to resolve the Israel-Hamas war. But Blinken's visit indicates Turkey could have a role to play. Asla Aydintashbaş is with the Brookings Institution in Washington.
There might be a need for Turkish diplomacy and Turkish leverage in convincing Hamas to work with the Palestinian Authority and providing policing and counter-terrorism or even a sort of a basic governance structure for Gaza. And I think there Turkey will have a role. The other issue is, of course, I think the administration has realized that keeping Turkey out is not moderating Erdogan's tone.
Washington and Ankara also share concerns about the possible contagion of the war in the Middle East. But Blinken's talks in Istanbul also focused on NATO member Turkey's failure to ratify Sweden's application to join the military alliance. Erdogan insists the US Congress approve the sale of American F-16 military jets. But Washington says Ankara must ratify Sweden's membership first. Analysts say Ankara is skeptical of whether President Joe Biden can deliver, given his ongoing difficulties in persuading Congress to sanction military aid to Ukraine. Sezin Öner of Politikyol News Portal.
Biden cannot be exerting pressure over the Senate and House of Representatives for the sake of Turkey. I mean, he couldn't do it in case of Ukraine. He's struggling with that. So how can he do it on behalf of Turkey, which doesn't deliver anything, and on top of it, supports Hamas?
Observers say Blinken likely warned Erdogan that the longer the impasse continues, the more antagonism will grow towards Turkey in the US Congress. The ratification of Sweden's NATO membership bid gives Ankara important diplomatic leverage, not only with Washington, but also with the European Union. At the same time, analysts warn that by delaying ratification, we'll have its motives questioned by its NATO allies because of Erdogan's ties with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sinan Ülgen is an analyst with the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies, an Istanbul think tank.
Criticism that Turkey is doing this because there's a deal between Turkey and Russia to block or to postpone NATO enlargement, which also includes Hungary. I don't think that's the right way to look at it. Turkey is doing this for its own concerns and in order to maximize the returns to its national interest.
With the Turkish parliament due to reconvene later this month, Washington is pressing for an early vote on Sweden's application to join NATO. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. On Saturday, Taiwan will elect a new president and legislature. That vote will determine Taiwan's ties with China, which threatens to take over the small island democracy. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Taipei, the vote also has major global implications.
Democracy in action as Taiwan enters the final stage of a general election. The big question is how to preserve these kind of events at all amid threats from China, which sees Taiwan as its own. At this rally of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the solution is to keep pushing Taiwan's sovereignty.
Instead of relying on China, it's best to trust Taiwan. It's better to embrace the world.
That is the approach of outgoing President Tsai Ing-wen. But under her administration, China has become more aggressive. Main opposition candidate Hou Yu-i wants dialogue with China to lower tensions. Supporters of his Kuomintang party say the risks of not getting along with China are too high.
Small country like Taiwan, we have to play smart. We cannot afford to went into war with China.
Under Tsai, Taiwan has increased military spending and sought closer ties with the United States. China has responded angrily, once even encircling Taiwan with missiles, a sign it has become more difficult to preserve the status quo.
And really to maintain stability in the Taiwan Strait, given that we are dealing with a much stronger China, given that the U.S. and China are in a strategic rivalry, and Taiwan is really quite steadfastly uninterested in unification.
But few in Taiwan seem concerned about war, despite the Chinese threat.
Just because there's a lot of fighter jets flying around Taiwan from the PRC doesn't mean that people in Taiwan go to Starbucks any less, because it's been going on for decades and decades, and that's not going to stop people from living their everyday life, even if they are keenly aware of what's around them.
Here in Taiwan, what really matters to many voters isn't necessarily the United States or China. The big focus here is how to preserve democracy for as long as possible. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Taipei.
There's an American axiom, as old as the nation, that no one is above the law. not even the president. In former President Donald Trump's trial on federal charges that he tried to overturn the 2020 election, Trump claims he is immune from criminal prosecution. That argument has already been rejected by a lower federal court, and on Tuesday, it will be argued before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. Dr. Alex Batis is with the University of Houston, where he teaches courses on judicial behavior and constitutional law. So, what are the outcome options we can expect from the court?
Yeah, so there's a few different components to this. Well, they could decide the substantive issue of whether Trump has this immunity that he's claiming or not. Or two, they could also decide that the trial date should be pushed back a little bit further. So Trump wants to kind of delay the trial as much as possible as terms of a strategy, because he would much rather prefer it happen after the election, so it kind of doesn't interfere with his presidential campaign much at all.
So what argument are they making to the court about the immunity?
Yeah, so there's kind of this idea that sometimes governmental officials have immunity as they're carrying out tasks associated with their position. Sometimes we think of presidents having immunity from certain actions, and they're saying that kind of immunity extends to these kind of criminal charges against him. So they're kind of saying that the charges against him, which are, you know, inciting the events at the Capitol and all this sort of thing, were part of his official duties, and therefore he shouldn't be held liable for those because he was acting in his position as president.
So is there any precedent to support that?
Yeah, so this is there's been, you know, some cases which grant presidential immunity for some actions, but nothing like this in a criminal context, especially in a context where Trump is kind of claiming that he has absolute immunity from any sort of prosecution for criminal misdeeds once he was president. So kind of his argument in this context is very unprecedented, and I think it's going to be a very hard sell for judges to buy into that argument.
One of the things I saw that makes, you know, that somebody was saying that is on their side goes back to Nixon.
So even Nixon initially claimed that his, you know, the tapes were privileged, right? And that case made its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that Nixon's, sure, there is presidential immunity, or presidents have the ability to keep their records closed, but that doesn't apply to all situations or all contexts, and especially in the context of Nixon's criminal misdeeds, that he would have to give up the tapes.
So they still have room above this Court of Appeals if they lose, right?
Yeah, so if they lost at the Court of Appeals and either the court said, no, we're going to have the trial started immediately, or no, that there is no presidential immunity in this context, Trump could then appeal that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, and of course, beyond the courts and their decisions, there is an aspect of politics and theater to all of this for Trump, no?
Trump will be there at the hearing tomorrow, so that's going to, you know, be something where he's going to get a lot of attention, and he kind of tries to use these events where he's being prosecuted to sort of mobilize his supporters. It's a compelling message to them.
Well, particularly when you have, you know, a vast number of people, regular citizens, who don't really understand the nuance of going to court and these kind of decisions. And it's emotional for them more than it is gray.
And I think Trump is really good at kind of playing to those emotions of his supporters and trying to kind of have them collectively share in the sense that I'm being prosecuted. This means that you're being prosecuted as well, and we need to take some kind of action to defend ourselves, or we need to have some kind of mobilization effort to, you know, stop these perceived injustices.
Dr. Alex Batis at the University of Houston. We're following these other stories from around the world. The first U.S. moon landing attempt in more than 50 years appears to be doomed after a private company spacecraft developed a critical fuel leak just hours after launch on Monday. This loss of fuel is now dimming hope for the planned moon landing, which they had hoped would happen on February 23rd. Both the White House and Pentagon said Monday they would look into why President Joe Biden and other top officials were not informed for days that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had been hospitalized. Pentagon spokesman pointed to one reason. A key staffer was out sick with the flu. United Airlines said Monday it has discovered loose bolts on Boeing 737 MAX 9 planes in its fleet during preliminary inspections. Those inspections follow that Alaskan Airlines mid-flight incident where a panel flew off the jet in flight. United said it has found instances that appear to relate to installation issues in the door plug. For example, they say, bolts that needed additional tightening. A former Gambian minister went on trial in Switzerland on Monday for crimes against humanity in a milestone case where a serial rape victim will testify after a multi-decade wait for justice. Here's Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham with more.
A former Gambian minister went on trial in Switzerland on Monday for crimes against humanity. It's a milestone case where a serial rape victim will testify after a multi-decade wait for justice. Former Interior Minister Usman Sonko served under ousted dictator Yahya Jammeh. He becomes the highest-ranking official to be tried in Europe under the principle of universal jurisdiction, which allows grave crimes to be prosecuted anywhere. That's according to the Swiss campaign group Trial International, which filed the complaint against him. Nine Gambian plaintiffs are coming to Switzerland for the hearing.
I am smelling justice.
Madi Sise is now 67 years old. He alleges he was falsely imprisoned and tortured under Sonko.
I'm so optimistic that at least justice will be done. And I always say, even if it has stopped where it is now, for the past 6 years, he's pinned down at one place. That alone, I think, is a kind of a relief for me.
Sonko was arrested in early 2017 while seeking asylum. He faces charges including murder, multiple rapes, and torture between 2000 and 2016 in what is Switzerland's second ever trial for crimes against humanity. He denies the charges, but if convicted, he could face the maximum penalty of a life sentence. Sonko's lawyer, Philippe Curat, asked the court to abandon the case, citing problems with the investigations and hearings. He is expected to argue that many of the alleged crimes against humanity happened before a relevant Swiss law took effect in 2011 and are not admissible. Former President Jammeh's 22-year repressive rule ended in January 2017 after he lost an election and was forced to flee. Fatoumata Sandeng is eager to see the trial unfold. Her father was an opposition activist who was killed in custody in 2016.
We are hoping that we could get Jammeh one day, because that is the ultimate goal. If we don't hold people accountable, things like this will keep happening in the Gambia, in Africa, all over the world.
Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. And finally, as the planet warms, the conditions are more hospitable for mosquitoes. We reported this a few months ago in a story about climate change. Mosquitoes are showing up in places they've never been before. And some mosquitoes carry the virus that causes dengue fever, something some of these regions have also never seen before. Enter technology. Shelley Schlender says there's a group working on robots with artificial intelligence to hunt down mosquitoes carrying the dengue fever.
The World Health Organization says dengue fever is the world's fastest growing mosquito-borne disease. In Taiwan, health officials here in the city of Kaohsiung are teaming up with local technology firm Geosat to develop this little robot to hunt dengue mosquitoes inside narrow underground rainwater ditches.
We can use the machine to find the hiding breeding source.
The robot is on the lookout for wiggly mosquito larvae like these. Kaohsiung health officials have long urged residents to drain potted plants and tires, anything holding water where mosquitoes can breed. Officials used to not worry about insects breeding in the ditches back when they carried household sewage, which dengue mosquitoes do not like.
Before, the water in these ditches used to be dirtier, more smelly. Since the introduction of the new sewer system, it has become cleaner. But ironically, this is when the problem started to arise.
Dengue-carrying mosquitoes prefer laying their eggs in the cleaner water.
Mosquitoes are like human mothers. They want their children to grow up in their ideal environment.
A mosquito-catching gravitrap shows this street has a high dengue mosquito population, and beneath this rainwater drain there are puddles and larvae.
We can now put the machine in the ditch.
Into the narrow tunnel creeps the robot. When it finds puddles, technicians mark the spot on a ditch database so the health department will know where to blast insecticides to kill mosquito larvae and steam to kill eggs. Kaohsiung Mayor Chen Chi-mai says city health officials are working with Geosat developers on the next generation of dengue fever robot.
New technology and application will change the strategy of prevention.
Improvements include enabling the robot to spray insecticides and steam on its own and to use artificial intelligence to identify the mosquitoes that carry the virus that causes dengue fever. They plan to also use robots to release lab-borne mosquitoes containing biological controls that prevent future generations from transmitting dengue fever. Shelley Schlender, VOA News, Kaohsiung, Taiwan.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Reverend King was a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama and a leader in the fight against racial inequality in the United States. Reverend King died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968, at the age of 39. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 95th birthday. Reverend King lived in a time when racial discrimination was rife in many parts of the United States. For nearly a full century after the end of the Civil War, most of the African American population was subject to so-called Jim Crow laws that in effect denied them the rights that go with full citizenship. Taking inspiration from the Christian Bible as well as from Russian writer Leo Tolstoy and Indian activist Mahatma Gandhi, Reverend King organized and participated in nonviolent mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other acts of civil disobedience. Hoping to draw attention to the inherent unfairness of Jim Crow laws, African American activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating whites from non-whites. And although it was a long, tough fight, their efforts bore fruit. In 1964, the U.S. Congress passed and President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, which outlawed segregation in public places, as well as employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, gender, or national origin. Dr. Martin Luther King was born into a nation where segregation was a tragic fact of life, said President Joe Biden. He had every reason to believe, as others of the generation did, that history had already been written, that the division would be America's destiny. But he rejected that outcome, said President Biden. Often when people hear about Dr. King, people think of his ministry and the movement, or most about the epic struggle for civil rights and voting rights. But we do well to remember that his mission was something even deeper. It was spiritual. It was moral, said President Biden. It's when we see each other as neighbors and not enemies that progress and justice come. Progress is never easy, but it's always possible. And things do get better on our march toward a more perfect union.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.